IVM.
Welcome to All Things Policy, a daily podcast supported by Pragati, a flagship media initiative of the Takshashila Institution. We are a bunch of policy nerds based in Bengaluru, and we like to bring fresh perspectives to Indian affairs and an Indian perspective to global affairs. So grab a cup of coffee, sit back, and join us for today's chat.
Hello and welcome to All Things Policy. I'm Aditya Parikh. Before we begin, I'll just like to mention that admissions are now open for our 12-week graduate certificate programs in public policy, defense and foreign affairs, technology and policy, and health and life sciences. Application deadline is 28th of August and the cohort begins 1st September. To know more, visit takshashila.org.in/courses. Now coming to today's episode. The Indo-Pacific stretches far and wide, but in popular Indian imagination, it has for some reason been equated only to the Indian Ocean littoral and the Bay of Bengal, Pacific Russia and the Kuril Island chain, or the Northern Territories, as they are called in Japan, are also very much part of the Indo-Pacific strategic concept. Newspaper editorials in Japan are buzzing with commentary on Russian Prime Minister Mikhail Mishustin's visit to the Northern Territories. There is bound to be some discussion about Russia on security matters from a Japanese lens. We recently discussed the newly published Defense of Japan white paper on this show, but to more deeply understand Japan's self-defense forces and the international law dimension of Japan's defense in the Indo-Pacific region, I have with me today Mr. Yoshihiro Inaba. Welcome, Mr. Inaba.
Thank you so much for inviting me.
Yoshihiro Inaba is a freelance writer living in Japan. He's particularly familiar with Japan's ground, maritime, and air self-defense forces. He currently writes for multiple Japanese military magazines as well as for Naval News, a France-based web media outlet. He is one of the few young military writers in Japan and is currently a student studying international law, especially self-defense forces and use of force at a Japanese graduate school. To begin our discussion, let me ask you, Mr. Inaba, what specific shared threats does Japan see in the Indo-Pacific region that it needs India's cooperation to counter? Is the Japanese maritime self-defense forces in a position to help the Indian Navy deal with the threats of intruding Chinese manned and unmanned systems in the littoral space?
Yes. First of all, Japan is, you know, currently under a variety of threats. There are several that require India's cooperation. For example, the North Korea. In order to stop the North Koreans from developing the nuclear weapons or chemical weapons and the ballistic missiles, the United Nations Security Council Resolution, or UNSCR, prohibiting the import and export of goods to North Korea had been passed. And however, the North Korea still receives fuel and supplies from foreign vessels at sea, so-called an illegal ship-to-ship cargo transport. In Japanese, this is called the sedori. And in order to stop this cargo transfer, it is necessary to monitor ships sailing in the China Sea and the Sea of Japan, which requires a large number of aircraft and ships. Therefore, the participation of Indian naval vessels in these activities is very important for Japanese security and also the stability of the regional security. In fact, so far, not only the U.S., but also the United Kingdom, France, Canada, New Zealand, and Australia have dispatched naval vessels and aircraft, particularly the maritime patrol aircraft, to these surveillance activities. And furthermore, Japan would be very grateful for the support of the Indian Navy and Air Force in restraining China's military activities in the East China Sea. In particular, if India takes a cooperative stance with Japan and the United States in the Indian Ocean and the South China Sea, for example, when China takes military action in the East China Sea, China will not be able to devote all its energy to the East China Sea. This is very important for Japanese and the United States military operations at the East China Sea. And for your second question, the GMSDF has recently been deploying naval vessels, including Izumo class DDH, to the Indo-Pacific region since 2017. This year, the 2021, from August to November, the GMSDF will deploy the Kaga and two destroyers, as well as submarines and P-1 maritime patrol aircraft to the region. This is an indication of the importance that Japan considers the region, including India, to be. Furthermore, if a country with which Japan has a close relationship is attacked and its own security is threatened, Japan can then provide logistical support to that country or, in some cases, exercise its right of corrective self-defense to defend that country. The Indian Ocean is an important sea lane that is indispensable to Japan's economy. Therefore, I believe that the possibility of Japan dealing with military attack on India is not insignificant. In addition, in order for Japan and India to further cooperate in the area of security, it is very important not only to strengthen cooperation between the governments, but also between the armed forces. For example, by unifying communication procedures. From this perspective, the military exercise Malabar, which is being conducted by Japan, the United States, India, and recently the Australia, is very important. This is my point.
Very interesting. And here in India, we also watch Malabar very carefully as an exercise which could bring together all the countries which are concerned about the security situation in the Indo-Pacific. So you recently wrote an article which in part argued that Japan shouldn't object to Russian ships conducting missile exercises in Japanese EEZ. So because it's completely legal under UNCLOS, that if Japan objected, it would find itself in the same league as China and North Korea. Interestingly, India also insists that anyone even entering its EEZ, its exclusive economic zone, inform in advance. So what are your views on this?
Yes, basically, the EEZ, exclusive economic zone, as you said, it's not the zone that is allowed to restrict the military activities of other countries. For this reason, I wrote in a recent article that Japan cannot legally condemn Russian military exercise. This is also true for India's claims. As you say, India has made very something of excessive claims regarding its EEZ. Unlike territorial waters, the coastal states can only exert jurisdiction or sovereign right over very limited objects such as natural resources and structure on the waters in the EEZ. Therefore, the claims that prior permission is required to enter the EEZ lacks a basis in international law. Particularly UNCLOS. It is for this reason that the United States has targeted India for freedom of navigation operation, or so-called FONOPS. That is my point.
Indeed. So UNCLOS, United Nations Convention on the Law of the Sea,
yes,
is something that most law-abiding, international law-abiding countries should really live by. And although there is some space for interpretation, some things are really clear. And if you look at India's Maritime Zones of India Act, our national legislation, you would find a very different story about the EEZs. Coming to the next question, so another one of your recent articles mentions that Japan's helicopter destroyers, the Izumo class and the older ones, are currently preparing to convert to carrying F-35Bs. So Japan's Imperial Japanese Navy during the Second World War was one of the foremost carrier-borne naval aviation powers. So how different would this new era of Japanese fixed-wing naval aviation would be compared to the past?
Yes, that is a very important point. In my opinion, the most fundamental difference between the carrier's force of the Imperial Navy and the Izumo-class DDH of the GMSDF is the purpose for which the aircraft are operated. In the Imperial Navy era, the carrier-based aircraft were used to attack enemy fleets, the United States fleets or the United Kingdom fleets, and bombard the ground targets. In other words, it was a means of power projection. However, in the case of the Izumo class, the purpose of the installing the F-35B is the first to enhance air defense capability in the Pacific Ocean and the East China Sea, the second to support the U.S. Marine Corps, and third to strengthen Japan's presence overseas. With regard to the first point, Chinese aircraft, some kind of bomber or the fighter jet or reconnaissance plane, have been expanding into the Pacific, not only the East China Sea, in recent years. And the need for an operational base and aircraft to deal with this has become a factor. As for the second point, the U.S. Marine Corps is currently deploying F-35Bs at the Iwakuni Air Base in Japan, and the USS America, LHA, at Sasebo Naval Base at its mothership. The USS America is the only ship in the Western Pacific that can operate the F-35Bs. This means that if it cannot be operational, the F-35Bs of the U.S. Marine Corps will only be able to operate from bases on the ground. So, when such a situation arises, the Izumo class can take over and maintain the deterrent power of the U.S. Marine Corps. In addition, even when the USS America is in an operational state, the Izumo class can act as a refueling and resupply basis, making it an important force multiplier. With regard to the third point, as I mentioned earlier, the JMSDF has been sending Izumo class to the Indo-Pacific region on a regular basis in recent years. Currently, only helicopters are carried on the Izumo class, but in the future, JSDF F-35Bs will be carried here as well. I'm sorry, the JSDF is the Japan Air Self Defense Force. Or maybe not only JASDF, but also American and British F-35Bs will be carried on board. If this happens, Japan's presence at that region is expected to be very significant. And in addition to these points, the number of F-35Bs on board the Izumo class is extremely limited, and the missions required will be limited to airborne warning during anti-submarine warfare and offshore supply bases in case of a contingency. In this respect, too, the nature of the Izumo class is quite different from that of the aircraft carrier of the Imperial Navy era. That is my point.
Interesting. So this era of Japanese fixed-wing naval aviation would be a very cooperative one. A very coalition of the willing kind of a thing. Very interesting to know that. So is there a tangible threat to submarine telecom cables by Chinese or Russian gray zone activities? Is it feasible to say that Japan's digital connectivity can be threatened by Chinese or Russian fishing vessels, survey ships, or underwater autonomous vehicles if they wish to cut undersea cables connecting Japan? And suppose if cables were cut, what legal recourse would Japan have under international law?
I am not an expert in this field, but submarine cables are a very important infrastructure for Japan, but particularly about the Japanese economy. 99% of Japanese international communications are via submarine cable, not via the satellite communications. So any disconnection of these cables would seriously damage the Japanese economy and Japanese diplomacy. It is believed that Russia and China, particularly China, have the ability to locate and cut these Japanese submarine cables via the UUVs. In particular, if the some kind of a military submarine cable is cut. It will interfere with the operational activities of the JSDF, Japanese Self-Defense Forces, and the U.S. military. Therefore, these Chinese and Russian activities are a serious threat to the Japan, particularly the Japanese security and Japanese economy. From the perspective of international law, if these submarine cables are simply cut during peacetime, I think it cannot be considered an attack against Japan, and Japan will only be able to pursue state responsibility against that country and receive compensation. However, if a military submarine cable is cut in the middle of the crisis, this could be seen as the beginning of an attack against Japan, so the Japan can legally respond with the use of force against those activities. That is my point.
Interesting. So the state of war or peace would determine what legal recourse we have, what is legal and what is not in terms of submarine cables being cut. So on that note, folks, we'll take a short break now. We'll be back in just a bit. Welcome back, folks. We were discussing Japan's security situation with Yoshihiro Inaba, and now I'd like to focus on Russia a bit more from the Japanese lens. So, Mr. Inaba, for my next question, on the northern territories, Russia has deployed a lot of advanced air defense system. In its Far East and Kurils, there's an S-300 V-4 stationed on Kunashiri and S-400 on Sakhalin. How much of a counter are such systems to Japanese air power over the Sea of Japan?
That is a very important point. As you mentioned, Russia has placed a number of advanced air defense systems in the northern territories. And also, they deploy the some kind of anti-ship missile as well. Currently, the JASDF, Japan Air Self Defense Force, had F-15J and F-2 fighter jets in the northern part of Japan. But the F-15J has no ground attack capability, so the F-2 is important one. Although the F-2 has ground attack capability, including a JDAM, Joint Direct Munition. However, Japan is not currently equipped with anti-radar missiles such as the AGM-88, which are necessary to destroy this type of air defense system. Therefore, it is impossible for Japan to deal with this system alone at present. This is a result of Japan's dependence on the United States for some kind of offensive capabilities at the basis of its defense strategy. However, a modified version of the ASM-3 air-to-ship missile currently under development by Japanese MOD uses a passive seeker in addition to the active seeker. And it's expected to be able to operate as an anti-radiation missile. This missile is scheduled to be operated by the F-2. And also the next generation fighter jet. In addition, the JSDF is now deploying the F-35A, which will be sequentially deployed in the northern part of Japan. The F-35A has excellent stealth capabilities, making it difficult to detect by air defense system. In addition, the F-35A can be equipped with the JSM, long-range air-to-surface missiles. And this, in combination with ASM-3, as I mentioned earlier, will allow Japan to increase its strike capability in the future against such advanced air defense system of the Russian. That is my point.
Interesting that you brought up missiles. So Russia often expresses its concern over Japan's military cooperation with the U.S., and claims that all these exercises and military hardware is not aimed at Japan or its forces, but U.S. forces which are stationed in Japan. So the issue of precision strike missiles under the U.S.'s proposed Pacific Deterrence Initiative, PDI, being the latest example, some experts in Japan also argue that if the northern territories are ever back in Japanese control, Russia fears U.S. will deploy military hardware there to curtail Russian military's power in the region. What are your views on this?
This is a very difficult question. The reason why the Japan has taken a very harmonious stance toward Russia so far is to facilitate negotiation for the return of the northern territories. However, if the northern territory are returned, Russia will become a pure military threat to Japan rather than a counterpart in territorial negotiations. In such a case, I think Japan would have high expectation for the U.S. military deterrence. And I think it is not unlikely that Japan would accept the deployment of such weapons, long-range missiles, if the U.S. requested. However, for the same reason, there is also the possibility that the deployment of such weapons will be difficult as a result of a consideration not to excessively provoke Russia. That is my point.
All right. So let's talk about Japanese experts on the issue. So although by and large, Japanese experts don't advocate a direct antagonistic attitude towards Russia, but a few have suggested that Japan should change its approach and exercise some of its strength by, for example, blocking the Soya and Sugaru Straits, which will have a direct impact on Russian Far East's seaborne economy. What do you think of Japan taking such an approach?
If such a blockade of the Straits, Tsugaru and Soya Straits, were to be implemented in peacetime, it would be in violation of international law. This is because Japan has deliberately limited the width of its territorial water in the Tsugaru and the Soya Straits. And the central part of both straits is high seas, not the territorial sea of Japan. Therefore, blockade of these straits would be a violation of the principle of freedom of the high seas. Moreover, taking such measures in peacetime would have a serious negative impact on Japan-Russia relations. Therefore, it is unacceptable to take such action in peacetime. However, if Russia were to attack Japan, then it would become the war situations. The JMSTF could lay mines in these straits. However, this is a legitimate exercise of the right of self-defense. In fact, during the Cold War, it was planned that the JMSTF would blockade the strait with mines and submarines in response to a Soviet invasion. Currently, the JMSTF has the multiple way to blockade such straits, as I mentioned. So that is my point.
Interesting. Thank you, Mr. Inaba. This has been a great conversation, and we'd love to have you on again on the show for many such conversations.
Thank you so much for inviting me to such great events. This is a grateful honor for me.
On that note, folks, we'll wrap it up. If you enjoyed today's discussion, do check out all past and future episodes of All Things Policy.
If you liked our show, don't forget to check out other interesting podcasts on the IVM network. You can tune into them on the IVM Podcast app, ivmpodcast.com. or wherever you listen to your podcasts. You can also follow IVM on social media. The handle is @IVMPodcasts on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. And hey, if you'd like to dive into Takshashila's research on technology, strategy, and economic affairs, check us out at our Twitter handle @TakshashilaInst or our website takshashila.org.in.
Hey, it's been another great week on the IVM Podcast Network. On All Things Policy, Ananya Desai and Rohan Pai discuss recurrent bans on fireworks during festive seasons in India and discuss possible solutions to tackle India's air pollution problem. On the Habit Coach podcast, Ashton Doctor welcomes Sahil Mehta, an esteemed mountaineer and author of the book Break Free. Sahil shares a transformative experience which became the catalyst for embracing discipline and fulfillment. The episode explores the profound impact of vulnerability on personal growth. Folks, if you like our shows, do spread the word. Tell your friends and don't forget to rate and review them wherever you're listening to them. Follow us on social media. We are IVM Podcasts on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram and LinkedIn. You'll also find all our shows on YouTube at youtube.com/IVM Podcasts. And finally, we would like to thank our sponsors this week: Omidyar Network India, Abbott, IDFC First Bank, and Save Life Foundation. Thank you for making this possible.